Hello and welcome again to Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Schoeschenwerks, a global firm that helps organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Ecosystemic Futures investigates this expansive and hyperconnected paradigm and explores frameworks to help us achieve more beneficial futures. I'm Diane Fickhausen, CEO of Schoeschenwerks, and I'm honored to introduce a very special session today.
Today, we are thrilled to have on with us Leslie Kane. Leslie Kane is eminent as an American journalist and as a best-selling author. She has a rich history across so many topics, and this includes space technologies. She is the person who many have credited as having the biggest story of the decade, perhaps the century. Some would say this is the most transformative story. The question of what are UAPs, unidentified anomalous phenomena? And there's so many facets to this, but we're welcoming Leslie here today. And Leslie, I've read your book. I wish I had reread it recently, so I don't remember all of the areas of your insights offhand, but you know, it's really a seminal work. Your reporting with so many of these big stories and the videos that come out of the Pentagon. Please do share with us your introduction and tell us all these amazing things that you've done.
Thank you.
You know, just in highlight intro form, and then we'll dig into some of the big stories in depth.
Yeah, that's a big question. You just tell me everything you've done. Yeah, so I'm really pleased to be honored today on this podcast. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I hope what I have to say is going to be helpful to people. And just to give some background, I started reporting on UFOs, what were then called UFOs, back in the year 2000. My first story was published in the Boston Globe in 2000, and it was based on a French report that I had received a copy, a translation of, called the Cometa Report, which people who have studied the topic are probably familiar with, but not many.
It may not be.
But it was a report written by French admirals and generals and a police chief and the former head of the equivalent of NASA in France, and scientists and engineers, about 13 of them, formed this committee. And in 1990, I believe it was 99, they came out with a report based on a 3-year investigation they had done of official UFO cases all over the world. And a colleague from France sent this to me and said, hey, here's an English translation. You're the only person that has this. Are you interested in it? It's not if you want to do something. And I read that report, and it was really life-changing to me and mind-blowing, because I was at that time just a reporter working at a public radio station in California, just covering all kinds of stories that happen around the world. The conclusion, which was so stunning in this report, after reading through these case studies they did, was that they said the most valid and rational explanation for the phenomenon that they had observed with these cases was the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And in those days, this was so taboo. So for high-level military people to say, we believe...
And sorry, Leslie, what was the year? Can you remind us? You might have just stated it.
The year that I received it was 1999.
Yeah.
And it had just come out. And it was like, I was sitting there as a reporter realizing that generals and admirals from France were saying that it's very likely that we're being visited by extraterrestrial spacecraft. Because they said this is the most rational and valid way to explain these cases. Because they looked at cases for which they were able to eliminate conventional explanations, which means there was enough data to make that determination that it wasn't this or that or the weather or a radar blip. Now, you have to have a lot of data to be able to rule out these things, and that's what they did. So anyway, as a reporter, I just recognized this is a huge story. I thought it was a huge story that people at these levels were making a statement like this, even if there was a small chance. Don't we want to look into this? So that's what got me going on this, to make a long kind of going on and on about it, but just so that people understand that that's how I got launched, because this report just blew my mind and I started looking into this more, and I was able to write a story based on this French report for the Boston Globe, which was published in May of 2000.
And Leslie, that's amazing. Just you've probably shared this previously. If it is shareable, I mean, obviously, to be the first person in the United States or in English to receive this, and to be the first person who's credible enough to be published in a long time in a serious outlet like the Boston Globe. Could you tell us more about how you were in that position, or was that easy? Was that challenging? You know, there's both the sourcing, but then there's the placing into the Boston Globe.
I mean, it was very difficult, Anna, because the only reason I was able to do it was because I had previously published with the same editor at the Boston Globe who accepted this story. And I published a number of other stories with her on other topics. I had done a lot of work on Burma, the country of Burma, and I'd been there and I'd published stories with her about that. And she really respected the work that I was doing along with a colleague of mine who I was working with at the time. And so she was willing to consider the story for that reason. But I mean, it was bizarre to think back on how taboo it was and how difficult it was that at one point she dropped the whole story and she just said, you know what? I can't deal with this. And I was devastated because we worked on it for months. She was so picky about the editing and everything. And I got her to come back on board, but she really edited the story a lot. And it was like this huge risk for her to do this. And I approached a lot of other editors who I'd written for in the past as well, who liked my work, and they wouldn't touch it. So it was such a different climate then when I think back to that, because, you know, now media like to cover the UFOs. I mean, but then it was like a risk for an editor, even about a topic like this, which was a military report from high level officials in France. So it was difficult, but it was so I just felt like, and I was like hiding from my colleagues at the radio station I worked at. I mentioned this to them and they were like, what? Are you crazy? And it was only after that story came out that I felt I had some legs to stand on because it was so well received. And there was no turning back for me after that. I was hooked on the topic and wanted to learn more and cover it more. And I wanted to understand, why is this so taboo? It didn't make any sense to me. Like, this is really interesting. And look what these people are saying. And these things are flying around. We don't know what they are. Why didn't anybody want to find out? I was very perplexed by the attitudes that were there in the culture. And so I did a lot of research on that. It took years and years.
And Leslie, I'm so eager to ask you follow-up questions for innovators, like on that leadership positioning. At the same time, I realize, in your introduction, we should get out some of, you know, your New York Times, your book, your other really big, just for people who are listening to kind of the bullet points of here are some of the really big stories that you've broken in this space. Could you share some of that with us briefly and then we can dive in to each of them?
Yeah. I mean, you want to go back before 2017 or do you want to start with
the? Yeah. Yeah. I think if you want to run us through the timeline of some of them and then definitely want to go more into, we can go into greater depth subsequently, but I think kind of those highlights of, you know, for people who haven't tracked all of your work, so they're wondering, Leslie, we know, is an expert in the space. What are some of the things she's done?
Yeah, okay. Because I can back up a little bit. I see it as two eras, pre-2017 and post-2017. And so, as I just mentioned, the first story was really sort of about national security questions related to UFOs at the time they were called, in relationship to this French report, because the focus of that report was to raise a national security concern and to advocate for pilot education on these topics. And so the second story that I did, which was in 2001, was about aviation safety issues and very much connects to the work that like Ryan Graves is focused on now. There was a NASA group at the time. A former senior scientist from NASA who was retired, his name was Richard Haynes, and he had set up a group to deal with aviation safety issues with regard to UAP because the government wasn't paying any attention to it. So he published a very interesting report documenting cases in which aviation safety was an issue for aircraft, for commercial aircraft mainly. Pilots having to dive to avoid a collision, planes being pulled off course by the proximity of a UFO, things like that. And I wrote a story which was syndicated all over the place. In those days, we didn't really have internet. Things went out on the wires, if everybody remembers the wire services. And so I wrote a story for, I think it was the Providence Journal, Providence, Rhode Island, which is a small state, but it went out everywhere all over the wire service. It went into Canada. And it was about the fact that, yes, UFOs cause aviation safety problems. That gave people a reason that they could legitimately care about this. It was sort of strategic as well as factual. I mean, there were lots of cases that documented these problems, but it was also an umbrella through which members of Congress and aviation world could go in and say, well, maybe we have to pay attention because it was focus on that element of it. So that was the second story. And then I did some other pieces around transparency, the need for the government to become more transparent. And then in 2007, another big milestone was a press conference I organized in Washington, D.C. with James Fox, a filmmaker. We brought in people from all over the world who are high-level military people and pilots who had direct encounters or who had investigated this topic on behalf of their government. That purpose led to me writing my book in 2010 because a number of the people that we were brought to the press conference were contributors to that book. And it was very much a book just sort of saying, oh, UFOs are real, folks. And I in those days, that was a radical thing to say, where now we accept that pretty much. I mean, anybody who doesn't isn't paying attention. So then it was like radical to come out and say, there really is a phenomenon here. It's physical. We don't know what it is. And it's a problem for aviation safety and it needs to be investigated. So that was sort of the point I made in my book. And I had chapters written.
And Leslie, can you remind me? So, and I very much, that's an extremely well-researched book. And obviously you got access to sources and information that there's a lot of depth that went into that. And it's been a while since I've read it. So I don't remember all the elements, but you made a very important point, which is that you're saying the UFOs are real. And certainly there's been a lot of data that's come out there. And we've been, you know, as we talk about the difference in time, because I remember when I was first hearing about this from some very high level people back when I was in the private sector about 15 years ago, it was kind of more people told you something, it could have been in a social environment, they'll kind of make a comment and it was a little bit hush hush, like you're in the know type thing. And contrast that with congressional testimonies, documents being released, declassified. It's just you and others have done so much work to really open this up. That said, and what we found is when we've spoken to at least certain groups of people, so this is where there's kind of an interesting tie between the then time frame and the now time frame. We talked to a large percentage of people who have seen or experienced anomalous phenomena, UAPs, UFOs themselves, or something that's very adjacent type of energetic or other type of phenomena. And because there hadn't been much talk about it in the past, I thought maybe this was a 1 in 20, a 1 in 100. Certain groups of people we're seeing, I mean, it's 30, 50% of people have seen something. Now, not all those people are saying it's extraterrestrial. Now, they might think it's terrestrial advanced. They might think it's something else. But in terms of do ultra advanced technologies exist, regardless of origin, that's something that a lot of people speak to from a primary standpoint and a secondary. But really, like we talk to a lot of people who share that from a primary standpoint in our personal capacities, people share it, people we've known for decades type thing. So when you say UFOs are real, are you just saying the technology themselves? Are you saying that are you stating what the origin is? What is the drill down on your assertion that UFOs are real?
Are you talking back when I wrote my book in 2010?
Well, no, now. So if we want to know how your thinking has evolved, you can, if there's a contrast, please share the contrast of what you thought then versus now.
Yeah. I mean, then it was just the statement that there's a physical phenomenon that's real. That was the focus because people didn't believe that. They really didn't. They thought UFOs were just a joke or a science fiction thing. And so it was very simple and basic in that way. And I had these high-level people who would write chapters for the book. I didn't just interview them. I invited them to write their own chapters, and they would all kind of reiterate that in their own words. Oh, yeah, I had an encounter. Yes, here's how I know this is real. So that was really the theme of the book, whereas now, first of all, the concept of what a UFO is has expanded dramatically. I think back, this was in 2010 when the book came out. And It was a New York Times bestseller. It was very well received, and just for making that simple point, but basing it on really high-level credible sources that provide the information. So the concept then, the focus that everybody had was what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis, which I referenced earlier. They basically thought these were craft coming from outer space. And the concept now is has broadened so much from that. I mean, and that's why we've changed the language. We now call them unidentified anomalous phenomena, which encompasses a huge range of types of phenomena rather than just craft coming from another planet, which I think the thinking now is much less that that's what they are. Certainly that doesn't explain a lot of the phenomena that we see. For instance, there's a lot of reports of small orbs that have become much more prevalent now, going through people's houses, going into their cars. Luis Elizondo, the former head of the Pentagon program, wrote about this in his book. So how does that fit in? Those certainly are not craft coming from another planet. So the whole concept of what this phenomenon is has expanded tremendously since I worked on it back in 2010. And in 2017, we learned about the government involvement. And then we've just learned a lot more about the types of interactions that people have and the types of craft or phenomena that they're seeing. And we don't know. It's just not simple. It's not simple. Plus, there's an element, like you were saying, about people who have their own sightings and it affects consciousness and they don't know if there's an if it's just pure energy. And some people talk about having communications, and there's just, it's so complicated that you can't put it in a box. And so my perception of it has opened up and changed to the extent that I really understand less about it now than I did then in a certain way, because I had a much more limited perspective on it then.
That's really interesting. I personally saw some advanced craft and things that were moving around with advanced characteristics in the sky and also orbs at fairly close range. So I kind of saw those phenomena at the same time. It was not clear to me, my limited expertise, and I didn't have a prior interest in this at the time. It wasn't clear to me. It was clear that this was very different from what I was aware of or used to. But I was kind of in this, is this extraterrestrial? Is this advanced terrestrial that I'm not aware of? So I can't speak to where it was from like what I've seen. But I have seen that linking of the orbs and the craft at the same time. And I think others have seen them both linked and then also separated. Do you find, and I was basically a nobody, or nobody at the time, or just on vacation type thing. I think what we found is this is something that's very common in terms of these. I kind of wonder if the anomalous in front of the phenomena is a misnomer. But again, we talk to inventors, scientists, highly successful business people. And what we found is that when there is that openness to having the conversation, sometimes it's closer to 30 or 50% of people have seen or experienced, whether it's the energetic phenomena like the orbs, which, you know, sometimes you say, you know, they behave similar to a drone, right? So that's not to say that they are a drone, but it's kind of an advanced energy thing that can hover, that can move, that seems like it is sentient or sentient controlled. Just the way you think of this is directed by something as opposed to random type motion. So what percentage, I mean, you've obviously spoken to a lot of people about this. Do you think that this is a high percentage of the population or certain segments have seen or experienced this on a personal basis?
I think it probably is a large portion. I mean, I don't have a sense of percentages, but it's amazing how many people have seen some kind of phenomenon that relates to the UFO issue. And like you said, I mean, it happens to everybody in all different countries and all around the world, different locations. There's not one type of person that has more encounters than others. We just hear more about encounters over, let's say, oversensitive nuclear bases or encounters that pilots have because they're up close to them and they need to report them. But so many people, individual people like you, Anna, who you say you're a nobody, that's not true. But, you know, it can happen to anyone in any location, and it does.
I think I'm probably the anomalous one in that I haven't seen any of it.
Well, I haven't either. So I think, yeah, there's just so much anomalous phenomena, as you're saying, out there that are a very broad spectrum of things that, and you can even get a human, advanced human psychic capacities can fit in that box. People that are precognitive or have telepathic abilities and things like that. And sometimes those things develop in people after they have an encounter with a UAP. So we're trying to figure out, like, what is the relationship between consciousness and UAP, and even concepts of related to the afterlife. I've written a book about that as well. You know, how does what people report on that realm, and there's a lot of research into it, how does it all interconnect, and how does it all relate to UAP, if it does at all? We don't really know. I mean, there's an element of UAP which is purely physical and technological, and it's still scum. It's an object in the sky. It can be detected on radar. We can observe how it moves. And those reports, what's interesting is that hasn't changed since like the 1950s. This very, very sophisticated technology that was observed back then. And I don't think anybody can argue that Russia, China, or the US had the capabilities back in the 50s and 60s that were observed continuously through that era. So it hasn't changed. And I think that's an important point. This is not something new.
And Leslie, I think we also had some recordings of what we saw. So it's kind of multiple witness kind of, you know, I think we're into this zone now where it used to be, you know, maybe in the 50s, people saw something and they probably didn't have a video camera on hand. But when we saw what we saw, we did have a phone available. I mean, it was a low quality phone. So some of the imaging and videos, but actually the ability even of citizens to record these things, it was very much an opportunity that was available that wasn't previously. I appreciate your bringing up the points on consciousness. Before going into that, I see we just had Christine join. Hi, Christine.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Great to have you. And do you want to give us a brief introduction?
Sure. I feel like I'm crashing the party.
That's okay. How long can you crash for? We always want to be sensitive to if people can crash for a while, we'll work you in later. But if you can only crash for a few minutes, we want to make sure we're receptive and responsive.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Christine Kim. I work in head of marketing at Enigma Labs, and we're an aerial alert network. And right now it's at a very exciting time as all the drone activity is now spotted in New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania. So we're on red alert because, you know, the public, they're looking for outlets to report what they're seeing.
If you've got time, we'll go back to Leslie and then we'll come back to you a little bit later, also potentially when Ryan comes on. So Leslie, we were talking a bit about the consciousness and how some of these areas interlink. And I think there are scientists right now who are really working to understand that unified theory. They're working to understand how this connects with, how is it an extension of current physics and current science? And so some people are really plugging it into existing paradigms and repetitive how things work. So I think there should also be an openness to, do we apply new frameworks, right? And do we not need to fit something into a prior equation? Yes, there's plenty of room there as well. But this question about these different things that come up, or these different observables or phenomena, one of the things that kind of informally sometimes we get in conversation, and I'll say, well, if you have a phenomena like electricity, right, you have different things that can operate off of that phenomena. So a hairdryer isn't a Tesla, isn't your toaster oven, right? But they all use electricity. So some of these phenomena, like when we talk about consciousness, or when we talk about how might it pertain to some of these, there's a lot more questions about UAPs, but much of the world are people of faith that they do believe in anomalous phenomena. They do believe in apparitions, angels, a wide range of things. Now, because there are things that might show similar observables, that doesn't mean that it's the same thing, right? So UAP doesn't need to be an angel, doesn't need to be, you know, like a communication across different distances or whatever it is. But there are people that are really working to understand that, and certainly the consciousness link. So Is there anything else that you would add on kind of that unified? Actually, Larry, maybe, I don't know, Larry, if you want to share or ask any questions. I know that Leslie's more in the investigative journalism and you're more on the advanced physics side of this.
Yeah, I told Anna that my goal was to license the technology from the out-of-towners.
And my goal is to fund it, right?
Yep, there we go. But
and to put the builders together. So, Leslie, if you have sources with technology, there's a home for it. And there are other people who can do that, too. So whether there's the who has visible access or not, Larry, go right ahead.
Leslie, I'm actually very curious about, I would call it, the sociological aspects of this, since you've followed it nearly a quarter of a century in detail with your book in 2010 and some related books. My question is, has there been a change in public acceptance of the idea, perhaps because of movies and books and things, or is it the recent disclosures from your original article in the New York Times? What's driving what's going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think there has been a change. Definitely there's been a change within the official world, as we've all observed, and we've seen the response by Congress, for instance. The Congress has passed legislation in multiple years. They've held open congressional hearings. So it ripples out when you have Congress taking this seriously and acting the Congress wants the executive branch to provide more transparency. There's sort of like the push. It ripples out. And I think the public who do read the media and are have a lot more exposure to this than they've ever had before. There are a lot more podcasts. There's a lot more reporting on it. It's taken seriously. Members of Congress have been briefed repeatedly. The issue that we do face, which especially for people interested in technology, is of course that the specifics of all of what is really known are classified. And so we have a whistleblower coming out and talking about programs in which these craft have been retrieved and the reverse engineering these craft to try to understand the technology. We're not told how much we actually have learned about that technology. Have we been able to reverse engineer the craft? Have we been able to create our own technology based on that? All of that is classified, so we just get little hints about it. But the fact that the whistleblowers have been coming forward, one of them being Dave Grush, who I reported on in June of 2023, it's really exploded as I see it since 2017. So I would say
So Leslie, can I ask a question about that? So obviously there's tremendous respect for the technological leadership that the Department of Defense has really across so many areas of technology. And certainly in any area of technology, there are things that are, whether it's classified or whether it's something that's held for companies don't share proprietary advantage as well. It's pretty normal that, you know, the private sector, companies that don't have government funding, they'll say, oh, we're in stealth mode as they seek to build something. So there's certainly things that are classified or held for proprietary reasons across sectors. But that said, so there's leadership and there's been disclosures from the Department of Defense that obviously everybody takes seriously. But this idea that everything resides in the Department of Defense, do you really think that? Or we also see that so many people have, you know, it's kind of like I say, it's like the sunrise. You know, you might see the sunrise at work, but the sun also rises when you're at home, right? So many people have seen these in their personal capacities, and that's something that includes scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, business people. So is it just that have you spent less time with those sources because they might be less credentials and you pursued the DoD path more? Or do you really think that this knowledge resides primarily in DoD as opposed to there's humans across the globe and in the United States that have access to the insights on some of this?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think that knowledge about the nature of the phenomenon resides with the Department of Defense. Because as you say, all the individuals that have the sightings and that are impacted by the sightings and see things and learn things as a result, they all have very valuable information. It's more, but their information is more about how it affects them, what they're actually seeing. I mean, what the Department of Defense has and the Congress has are the specific details about government programs that are involved with these, with working on understanding UAP better. So I think there's
most
valuable. What's that?
Well, I'd like to address that for a second because you had a chance to walk around this whole thing. I have the strong sense from hearings this year and last summer that the Congress has not been read into these programs. In fact, major portions of the DOD haven't been read into the programs. And there's been assertions that much of what has been uncovered, shall we say, resides with a very few aerospace programs that have been successful in even preventing the executive branch knowing what's going on.
Exactly.
You have any follow-on to that?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think what Congress does know now is some of the specifics about the programs that the whistleblowers have provided to them, such as the names of the programs, the locations, who's involved, how long they've been in operation, where objects have been retrieved, how the process has worked, things like that. But they know that, but it's not like they're read into the programs. You're absolutely right. So yeah, I mean, they know some of the specifics, but being read into a program like this is a whole different thing. And I don't think any of the members of Congress have been actually read in. They've just been told details from people who know about what's going on with the programs or who may. Yeah,
we have an expression referred to as stovepiping, and another one is rice bowl. So that if you got yourself in a little silo and you have access to information, then there's a great reticence to share that. And this has been true, not just in this field, but all across everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the second problem is, which is an attempt to counter it, information is the coin of the realm in Washington. And so there is a great concern that if any information is released, it's going to not just work against the individual's stovepipe, but it may actually affect things much larger. So there's kind of two things going on here. Concerns that people will leak things they shouldn't, but then there's also the concern that should be watching what's going on. I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, there is a concern. I think maybe what you're pointing to is within the Department of Defense and the military and national security departments, they don't want our adversaries to know what we have and what we know about this phenomenon. They don't want our adversaries to know what technology we may understand, what we may have developed. So that a lot of the reason for protecting the information is specifically for that. And that's the national security problem part. And that's why Congress can be told certain things. They're not going to make it public, because we have to protect it from adversaries, and there's sort of like a Cold War kind of thing going on among the leading countries of the world that are all trying to understand the technology better. So I think that's a lot of why we're not privy to more of it. And it's a legitimate reason to withhold a lot of it.
Well, and Leslie, one of the things that we're seeing publicly is that, I mean, obviously, you know, as you started at the beginning, some of the initial information you got access to was from France. I mean, this is a phenomena that happens around the globe. That's very well documented type thing. So if you have this phenomena around the globe, there is the ability for people in various jurisdictions to decide how to move forward. We've also seen on the National Mall of the United States of America at a public event where many U.S. speakers were present, there was a representative, a Chinese space center, who basically stood up publicly and said, oh, show us this, show us that. And some of that included alien life, some of that had to do with space-time distortion, some of it had to do. And so there are countries around the world that are saying, we want to be a magnet, send us stuff. I think there are many of us that say, if you want advanced technology, come to the United States, bring that information to us as a technology leader, shared values, et cetera. But people around the world do think about who they partner with on things like this. And there is, I guess one of the things that's a big change from 15 or 20 years ago is the level of connectivity, the level of citizens and sensor data the ability to access AI. It's a kind of this, and one of the things that when I look at the phenomena, how interwoven it is. And so as somebody who funds disruptive technologies, just if this pertains to advanced physics, if it pertains to energy solutions, quantum, you can't shut off. Well, okay, now there's this thing that we ignore it that might, you know, improve our communications or our material science. So even if somebody was to say that they don't believe in anything off planet, or they don't want data from, you know, the sightings, or if they want to shut themselves off from certain types of information flows, there's still the state of how do you advance these various fields. And it appears like some of them have overlap with some of the observables of the phenomena. So I don't see how you disintermediate this from biotechnology advances, energy, advanced materials. So it's very interwoven, which provides an opportunity to pursue these things, but you just can't splice it out is a challenge on the scientific side. So
I'd actually like to add something to that comment and see what your comment on this. Hal Puthoff has commented several times that people say, well, physics prevents these things from happening or being real. And his comment was, so the physics is not the problem. We just can't engineer it.
Exactly. And then that's exactly right. I've talked to Hal Puthoff quite a lot. And I think that's really an important message is the theoretical physicists can explain space travel through space at large distances, faster than light travel, however you want to call it. I'm not a physicist, but exactly right. It's the engineering that's the problem. And the amount of energy that it would require for us to engineer what these craft are observed doing is astronomical. So, but it isn't inconceivable that some very advanced civilization way ahead of us could do that.
I think a lot of us on the energy side are not bought into its astronomical energy. You know, sometimes things seem like a lot. Larry's smiling, so we wouldn't be talking about this. If we thought it was not achievable, we're focusing on the things that we think could actually happen. And to be clear, this is more of a portfolio approach. So it's not that we should set all of our sights on UAP observables or advanced physics being what provides advanced propulsion or energy storage or whatever else. But if we have pilots who are seeing craft, they're staying stationary in 100 plus wind or things that are staying in the air for 12 to 20, 24 hours, if we believe those accounts that this is operational, then it's being done somewhere, somehow, and it's being done in an attainable manner. So I personally would not be involved in the conversation if I thought it was astronomical energy that was not attainable. I don't know about you, Larry.
No, I think that's entirely reasonable. Several years ago, I was contacted by the Navy to provide some potential sensor means to determine whether or not a pilot encountering one of these craft actually had encountered something in addition to a forward-looking infrared radar and from multiple stations and things. I have no idea if what I had suggested was tried, but a lot of these things have to do with if these devices are able to flit around as they are without crushing the crew inside, there's an implication that they are adjusting gravity. And if that's true, there ought to be a signature. Anybody getting close to that, shall we say, little gravity well that the spacecraft finds itself passing through the environment. I'm just curious as to, I realize that you're not from a perspective of technology looking at this, but you know, what's gone rattling around in your cage on these things?
And with respect to, there's lots of things to rattle. You mean with respect to specifically, what specifically?
And feel welcome to send the technologies our way. So somebody wants to talk. So, because we realize that it's hard to kick the tires on the energy or the physics if that's not one's work. So I guess one thing is we're saying, what do you see that's exciting? But if the answer is that's not the field that you assess, in the future, feel welcome to send them our way.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, it certainly seems like you make the point, Larry, that many of these crafts, and especially in recent years, are not likely to be manned at all with any kind of biological organisms. I mean, some of them, the ones that Ryan Graves has talked about, are not very large. And yeah, that even the, it's a problem. The level of acceleration that occurs would kill any living being inside. But if they're in some kind of a bubble where they're not affected by gravity, then I guess it's a whole different story. So I think there are ways that physicists can explain how these things can operate.
So I have another question for you, also from kind of a sociological bent. And there's been a number of groups that have claimed everything from transistors to lasers were pyramids and everything else were technology left by either previous civilizations or by out-of-towners, if you will. I'm just curious as to what extent in your going through this, you think that there is technology we're currently employing that did not have a long history of development by humans that was obviously picked up by somebody else.
I don't have enough expertise. I don't have enough expertise to answer that question. I wish I did, Larry. I'm sure I just can't comment on it because I don't know. I just don't.
That's great. We totally understand. And then I guess one of the things that we find with, so just to kind of get back to some of the reasons that we do have this conversation. So we kind of are most active in some segments that are distinctive from some of the segments that are engaging on this, but it's people that are looking to develop the most advanced energy, communications, advanced materials, people, hundreds of scientists and entrepreneurs, thousands actually, who are at the forefront of their fields. And so it's kind of one of these things that there's no luxury to just ignore something if it might impact your business, your projects, or it might amplify what you're doing. So it's kind of a different group of people, and also some of the most forward-leaning investors who are used to getting into projects that, you know, maybe it has a 5% chance of working, but if it works out, this is that 10 billion plus, 100 billion plus company that is what drives the return in their entire portfolio. So it's less about every single one needs to work, and it's more about people who are successful at identifying those outliers. In the portfolios that I've funded, certainly not every company has reached that high growth scale, but I've funded multiple unicorn startup companies from their early days, dozens that are over 100 million in valuation. So just the richness of that exploration of the art of the possible, we see that out of those communities are the most forward inventors and entrepreneurs, that we can get well over 100 people on a call to discuss this. And it's very much from the what do we build here, curiosity driven. And that doesn't mean people are able to dedicate all their time to it necessarily in some of these cases, but people that are willing to bring expertise across a wide range of fields into the space. So tremendous, tremendous interest. I think interest is always caveated with is there money to pursue this? So that's an opportunity for people who look at this from more of a portfolio approach, where they have the opportunity to really have the most disruptive technologies, but for those that can ensure that there's going to be that leading technologies, regardless of whether it's this one, that's kind of probably a safer play. So stigma is something that in those groups, I mean, many of the most advanced technology entrepreneurs, whether it's a battery company, whatever it is, they still run up against stigma. So when people have a UAP sighted in, people don't believe them. They might have radar data. They might have images. So they have proof. When an entrepreneur says they're going to build something that doesn't exist, they've got kind of a business plan. They might have preliminary data. Often they don't. So there are groups of people that are really used to, whether it's a battery, whether it's reusable launch, or in the case of SpaceX, those technologies, the people in the early days say, no way, not going to happen, regardless of what it is. So these people are used to breaking through disbelief and stigma in all areas of technology and innovation. You've got so much experience breaking through stigma, disbelief. What type of advice would you offer innovation leaders, both in UAPs, but also more broadly, because every disruptive entrepreneur goes through this?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, again, I'm not an expert on how entrepreneurs operate, but I mean, if they want to avoid recognition for what they're actually pointing towards, they can always use a certain kind of language that sort of hides what they're actually talking about. If they want to play that game, or the other approach is to just go out full force and really acknowledge what it is that you're talking about. And if everybody does that, if there's strength in numbers, right? I do think, though, there's a huge change since 2017 in the level of stigma that we have now in our culture. And I don't know so much about the business world or the technological developers, people that you're talking about. But I mean, the Congress has recognized the validity and reality of this. And there are more and more scientists getting involved. So hopefully.
And we have presidents who have recognized the validity as well. Former presidents who have had sightings. Carter, maybe was it Ford as well?
Carter. But all of that was known, of course, before 2017. It didn't seem to help.
Yeah. And we've got, I mean, incoming President Trump has told us maybe that there's more to come that we can look forward to. So as you said, there's been a lot of validation. And as you bring up the point, and as I was saying earlier, this is so integrated with other areas that scientists and entrepreneurs can decide whether to, just explain the physics or the phenomena or the engineering or what they're building, as opposed to stating the link with observables of UAP sightings, whatever that info comes sourcing is. On the funder or investor side, what I can say is you get a lot more information when you say you're open. So for any funders or any investors, you get deal flow by funding. Right. So we've funded companies that are doing innovative work across these areas of energy and communications. And we see interesting approaches come forward. So that's something that the investors and funders who are thinking about doing on the quiet, that's certainly an option. And definitely if you know that you've already got access to a significant portion of the flow, but if you don't, there's a lot that's out there that you get what you ask for. So
I would.
We ask for it. We ask for it. We say, bring us your most disruptive across all the areas of technology. That is not UAP only, but we certainly don't have any embargoes against anything but narcotics.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, I would offer a counter to that because I've got a number of colleagues who have small businesses, some that have been funded by you, Anna, and they're very nervous about getting too close to anything relating to UAP, despite the fact the technology they're developing is very likely involved with what UAPs use, but their investors, or at least their perception of their investors, would be very skittish about involvement with things related to UAP. So they're just, and I've countered that by saying, well, look, if what you're doing has been demonstrable as Riot, these are beyond TRL-9, these are operational, and you have the possibility of accessing that, wouldn't you as an investor want to invest in that? So there's two sides to this.
Yeah, I would encourage people, too, to check out the Galileo Project, which is run by Avi Loeb of Harvard University in astrophysics. He's put together this very large, privately funded operation out of Harvard, and he's attracted a lot of scientists to that project, and he's somebody who's really had to deal with the problem of stigma as he's come forward. So I think for anybody who's sort of questioning that and is looking for some kind of guidance or inspiration, I think looking at what Avi Loeb has done would be really helpful to people.
Yeah. And I think, Larry, just to highlight what you're saying, and you're citing that people are nervous because of their investors. So what investors should hear is, there's an arbitrage opportunity here, right? So, and lots of investors are not diving into early stage disruptive technology anyways, but you're saying people aren't talking about it because there's a money issue. Well, by the way, there's a lot of capital that is on the sidelines. So if that capital is not deployed into areas of technology, they typically will not take off because people are paying mortgages, or they're putting food on the table. So you don't get innovation without paying scientists on administrative support on all sorts of things. So people go on road shows and all that. So when money's a problem, that's why we got to talk about it as well with investors. It's not for all investors, but let's be frank here. A lot of investors have seen this stuff. So when you're sitting across the table from investors, and they're investors who have the authority to make investors, and they're investors that they've got to check with other people and they've got their processes, but there's certainly people with capital who are primary sources on this. So if it's harder to have that conversation, it's harder to connect the capital with the opportunities. So I know that we've got Christine here. And Christine, do you want to kind of brief us a little bit on, so just kind of high level, and I will defer to when Ryan's potentially going to join us a little bit later, but whether in a few minutes or further from that. So he gave me some stuff that I can share as well. But as we talk about the pilot sightings, we got Ryan coming on, who is one of the, we expect, but there's a lot going on in motion. So if he's not able to join, he shared some information. So Ryan was one of the Navy pilots who gave congressional testimony, was seeing these UAPs on a daily basis. We did another podcast with Ryan and others recently. He's now got a nonprofit that is getting information from the private sector, from commercial pilots. So
a few weeks ago, where Leslie and Ryan had a panel discussion, and it was great discussion.
Yeah. So we know Ryan well, and we recognize that he's certainly in a position and has information to weigh in on with regards to these recent sightings in New Jersey. And I've got a list of whole bunch of other areas that this had been happening recently. And we realize that these super connectors who are in the flow, many of them now in the private sector. And by the way, if one of them steps out, another one can always step in to do this, right? So there's that access to data that Christine, we thought of Enigma too. So we're aware that Enigma, you have your app that brings in information. We just thought that potentially you'd be in one of these super connector positions where information comes to you. So is that the case, or we that's why we brought you on. We thought Enigma might know a lot about this. What are they seeing?
We're in the eye right now. So Enigma, to your point, we are our aerial alert network. So we want eyes in the sky, whatever it is, if it's a known object or not, preferably unknown. But since our launch, we reached a milestone of 28,000 sightings submitted to us. So we're really thrilled. Majority coming from the U.S., but we're seeing a lot of interest globally. So this is becoming a global phenomenon. It's bringing everyone, all the great minds together to solve this problem.
That's great.
Right now is obviously the biggest news story on the things in the sky is the drone story. So it started in New Jersey in late November. It has now spread to multiple states. So Pennsylvania was the second one. And now New York.
And Christine, just one moment there. So I was actually hearing about this in the summer as well.
Yep.
And around LaGuardia. So kicking off in November, but there's kind of been some more ongoing stuff before November, right?
I mean, people are spotting drones all the time. We get quite a few people who are unclear what drones look like. And at night, it looks very different as well. So people submit things because they're puzzled. They don't know what it is. And we will take it. We review it. So there have been obviously drone sightings before, not just this November, but I don't think it's ever happened in mass across so many states, across so many sensitive sites. So the ones we're particularly interested in are the ones near military sites. So arsenals in New Jersey. Should there be such massive drones at the largest airport in the country, right? So there's a security issue and just the frequency it's happening and across so many states is what's really interesting right now. And the news media, as well as the public, they want answers, and we're not really getting that right now.
So could you tell us, and I've heard some things, and there's things in the news, but kind of the what is being observed, like in terms of type of craft, lights, phenomena, what are the range of things that are being reported?
Right. So it is varied. So we get a lot of sightings where they're seeing triangles. So it could be multicolored lights that in the dark, it looks like the shape of a triangle. I think the size is interesting because most hobbyist drones, it lasts 20 minutes in the air. They're smaller, and we're seeing reports where it's car sized. So that's definitely of interest, right? And that it's hovering for so long. So a normal person, they don't have the drone that can have the battery power of staying in the air and fixate in one position for hours at a time. So all these things are interesting.
And Christine, that part's very important. So what's the length of duration?
Like, so what's the range you've heard in terms of how long they're up there?
Yeah, I've heard hours. Obviously, we've been getting a ton of reports from all the states, and we're getting so many daily. We're seeing double-digit increases in sightings month over many states. And well, just last night, people spotted them at LaGuardia in all the major boroughs last night, and the local news just broke that. So we sent out an alert to all our users in New York to try to get more sightings. So people are going online saying, I saw this too, what do I do? And there's no widespread or common reporting mechanism. People are really confused on where to report. So now we had a sighting where someone on the Leslie actually met with her. She had a sighting while she was sitting on a plane. It was very, very close to the plane. It was very fast moving, a black object. She was scrambling for answers. Her father was a veteran. She submitted to us, and we noticed right away that this was worthy of investigation. So we hopped on and we connected with her. We got her on the news. We connected her to Leslie. So yeah, we're looking for that kind of response where if it feels like a safety threat, as well as is this very anomalous and worthy of investigation, those are the cases we prioritize.
Christine, have you gotten any reports from San Diego?
You know what? The tri-state focus is the biggest focus right now. But as this story goes national, we are getting stories from, hey, I'm seeing this in Chicago. I'm seeing this in my state. So it feels like the West is maybe the next to go because this is not just a tri-state problem.
I was hearing about Chicago this morning, so I can't validate or refute that. But I was told that.
And Washington. And yeah, Oregon, some California.
The reason I bring it up is the local paper had a piece that appeared last night that there'd been multiple sightings, and San Diego obviously is a very large military community.
Right. Yeah.
But you don't have any, no one's called them into you yet.
We get reports from every single state. So right now we're focusing on tri-state, but yes, we've gotten reports many, many near military sensitive bases, Air Force. So yes, we do look at that, and there have been upticks. So Langley was a big case last year. So drones over multiple nights were spotted over Langley last winter, and it wasn't until this year that the Wall Street Journal broke that this had indeed happened, and we wrote a blog post about it. So I attended the Seoul conference like a couple of weeks ago, and the feeling was, all the attendees agree that this is not a moment for this year. This has been happening for years, and it just feels like now it's getting the attention it deserves.
Are you referring to NASA Langley or Langley, Virginia?
Langley, Virginia. Okay. So happy to send you the link, but there, Wall Street Journal broke a really big story about all the drones spotted in Langley last year, last winter.
Yeah, and I guess it is helpful to perhaps remind, I mean, obviously, in any one of these circumstances, you do want to aggressively figure out what's going on. That said, for those who might be nervous about this, just the reminder that there's a multi-decade experience of seeing these things. I mean, for the most part, things have been okay so far. So kind of calm in the face of the unknown while trying to really rapidly identify, don't understand what any threats or opportunities might be, I guess. So when you, obviously there's different entities that have access to different types of data, and we would expect that there would be folks that have radar on these, I would imagine. Do you get access to folks that have the radar data, or are you getting, what are you getting, like video? What access do you have?
We're getting a ton of video. We're getting audio recordings. We're getting photographs. And obviously, I think someone mentioned stigma and a fear of sharing public information. So we provide a safe space for people to report anonymously. However, we do allow opportunities for people with specific expertise to self-identify. So we get quite a few pilots reporting in.
Here's a great pilot who just jumped in. You, we hear great pilots coming in, and Ryan Graves magically shows up on the line.
That was amazing.
He flashed.
That Ryan's ears must have been burning.
So sorry, you were saying that you get a wide range of people.
Yes.
People with specific expertise, pilots.
People self-identify. So we get ton from veterans, from scientists, from pilots, from active law enforcement. And we're getting reports where people are saying, I'm using night vision glasses and other sensor data equipment to see some of these things. And those are obviously intriguing And we had a few this year where that we were really scratching our heads that we thought, okay, this is an exciting case and worthy of investigation because these are professionals seeing this. They're very excited to submit it to us.
And then Christine, on some of the observables, so not specific to this like group of sightings, but over time, do we hear people that are talking about things that are moving at ultra fast speeds or it's way beyond what's expected, G-forces, stationary energy storage in terms of, or just the ability to stay up in the air? We also hear of things that are moving more slow, normal, but they look unusual. We also hear things that flash in. So we've heard people say flash in. People talk about cloaking or other kind of, is it a very different type of transport? We talk to people about space time engineering. But so in terms of the observables that you're receiving, are you seeing any of this flash in type stuff, or is it more it's moving and it's moving in a different way or the same way as other things that are identified?
Yes. Yeah, so yes to all of those. Okay. So it's orange orbs. It's erratic movement from point A to point B in a second, right? Multiple sightings and by multiple people across same region. So that's really exciting when we have multiple witnesses seeing the same thing. So shapes, our top shapes are circles and spheres, obviously, but light is the second most common one. But you know, I think a lot of interest in triangle shapes. So 6% of our sightings are reported to be triangle shapes. So we're really excited about the data because we structured data is our focus and that we want to study it in a scientific way. So all of our sighting submissions have required fields of how long was it? How long was the sighting? How many witnesses were there? What color was it? What shape was it? Did it have any rotors or sounds? And so we're able to collect that information to analyze it in a, you know, structured, queryable way. And I believe that's what's needed for scientists to study it with the right data. And we're really focused on data integrity. We personally look at every single sighting submitted to us. We have a human moderate and look at the sighting. We contact some of the witnesses. Yesterday, I spoke to a witness who is a commercial captain. He's on the ocean. And I asked him, are you seeing things? You're in the water quite a bit. And he has very sophisticated equipment. He said he has $80,000 worth of equipment to look at things in the sky. So we love connecting to people like him because he's looking for community to talk about it, talk about his experience and find a purpose for the data that he's collected over the years.
And then when you get to that, like the whole AI or big data, when you think about the value of having access to more interconnected data as opposed to less, you know, that resides in more of a silo, there's in other fields of science, it's clear that the data is king in many of these cases. I know Ryan has a lot going on today. I definitely would be interested in going back to you, Christine and Leslie, and I want Leslie to have an opportunity to ask her questions as well. So, Leslie, did you have any questions for Christina? We just thought that it was so fitting that we've got one of the leading journalists in the world who's broken the top stories. So to have her here in this very exciting time with two or more people who can speak thoroughly to this, Leslie, we'd love, if you're willing, we'd love to just have Leslie ask some questions.
Yeah, we're big fans of Leslie over here.
Well, I'm big fans of what you're doing, too. Yeah, I mean...
And sorry, we'll let Ryan go first just because I know he's going to pop out, but then we'll come back. Ryan, you have access, as Christine does with Enigma, you have access through your networks and then also your sensing data to a lot of what's been going on both recently, but over the longer term. So just you kind of briefed me on a few areas earlier this morning, but what can you share?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And sorry, I can only stay for a few minutes. Very busy time right now with everything that's going on. So we continue to receive a lot of commercial aviation, veteran, military reports at Americans for Safe Aerospace. We've seen a lot of momentum within the aviation community, especially within the commercial aviation community, looking for proactive measures that they can employ in order to better report and understand on what they're seeing. And especially over the last year, I would say the number of reports have picked up quite a bit. The consistency of the reports are high. And I mentioned that to kind of lead into this conversation of what's happening over in New Jersey right now. This is the third year in a row that there have been unattributable objects operating near military facilities. specifically in the vicinity of Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, the East Coast, and now up into New Jersey. And if you look at it historically with the activities that occurred within the Navy, one might extend that timeline back much further as well. Now, are they all linked? I think that's a big question, but it's a bit hard to suss those details out right now. I personally haven't seen one particular video that has given me high confidence that there is extremely anomalous behavior going on. But when you look at the behavior in aggregate, both from a historical perspective as well as with the large frequency and number and consistency of these reports, it does give me pause that there is something that really kicked this off and that there may be a relation between what pilots have been seeing and what's been occurring in New Jersey. It's difficult to really picture to rationally consider a foreign adversary as operating within the normal confines of armed war and conflict by flying assets over our national airspace, which would essentially be, not even essentially, it would be an act of war, them essentially invading our airspace and our land, especially if any of these systems were weaponized in any sense. So the geopolitical ramifications of these incursions are quite high and serious. I have been speaking with a number of people actively involved in investigating these cases from an official perspective. And it seems like there is a bit of a hamstring that's going on right now between the legal authorities in order to properly detect and track these objects, since there's consideration of Fourth Amendment rights, since these are operating over a homeland. If these were commercial drones, it essentially needs to go up to the Deputy Attorney General in order to get permission to essentially wiretap these in order to better learn what the point of origin and egress is. And for any base commander that is willing to take the step forward of prosecuting any of these targets, their paperwork trail essentially goes all the way up to the Secretary of Defense. All right. So our law structures and our permission structures to engage in this type of potential combat are not well suited for the 21st century and to this small form factor drone warfare that you've been seeing the likes of in Ukraine and elsewhere. So I think that's a part of the indecision and holdup about further identifying what these objects are.
So Ryan, I want to ask you to share like the range of what's being seen, but I want to first give Leslie the opportunity to ask her top one or two questions based on her eminence in the field.
Yeah, so hi, Ryan. I've been talking to sources off the record.
I'm wondering if you think it's possible that this could be a U.S. technology that is being secretly flown for whatever reasons, whether it's to test certain things or whether it's to protect our shores from a potential invasion that could come in the future because of things getting increasingly dangerous in the world. I mean, I don't know, but I'm just wondering. I agree with you, but it doesn't seem like it could be adversarial technology. I mean, it seems unlikely to me that it's adversarial technology, and the Department of Defense has clearly made that statement. But what about the possibility of it being our own technology that's being secretly employed?
Yeah. I want to just add a caveat to my statement earlier about it not being a foreign adversary. There could be potential for a foreign adversary to use non-traditional actors in order to execute this type of mission, whether it's criminal organizations or other organizations that they may have influence over the United States, which would complicate the attribution of these objects as well as a potential response for violating the sanctity of our airspace and our national borders. So I don't want to completely dismiss that as a possibility. But as far as whether this is our own technology, I'm highly confident that that's not the case. I've said this many times before when discussing the activities over Virginia Beach, but we have very specific protocols, rules, regulations, and laws that prevent us from operating these classified technologies and limits them to very specific areas where those tests can occur. The general way to think about it is by flying, say, a SAP technology or even a top secret technology over the populace, they're essentially exposing them to that technology. And therein lies the legal barrier. They're essentially reading in thousands of people into these classified programs by doing that. And it's just not how we operate. And I can't imagine whether it be big DOD proper or whether it be a contractor trying to test some technology that they would take this conversation so far to instill such a panic when they're just trying to do routine test operations. I just don't see that as a feasible option at this point in the conversation.
I hear you. One other question I'm curious about is whether, I know you get so many pilots contacting your organization. Have you heard from any pilots that have actually been in the air close to one of these drones?
We've had pilots that have been close to these objects while they're in their approach and landing patterns, but not specifically correlated to the activities that are occurring in New Jersey at the moment. So these have been occurring over the past year in various parts of the country. What we're seeing now seems to be a condensed version of what they've been seeing over a specific locale. So I'm not aware of any pilots that have reported specific activity over those areas. They're such low altitude areas that pilot would essentially have to be in a low landing approach configuration, and they're legally bound to essentially not be distracted at that point, right? They have certain rules and regulations they need to follow to ensure that they're avoiding any type of mismanagement of their flight path. So that would be a hard area for them to get hold of, not to mention the various flight restrictions that have gone into place over some of these areas. So,
and Ryan, did you want to reference, like, in terms of the longer term recent stuff at some airports, or it's okay if not?
No, there's probably been 10 different airports in the United States where pilots have been on an approach or configuring the land where they've had various incidents with UAP at close proximity.
Ryan, I have a question for you. Is it a fair statement that most airport radar, first of all, is not capable of resolving something as small as a drone? And second, much of the radar ignores things moving as slowly as drones.
There is a potential. Well, let me just say this. A majority of the air traffic control systems in the United States have gone away from radar due to their ineffectiveness compared to transponder information. So the vast majority of situational awareness that FAA utilizes to guide traffic is based off of transponders instead of radars. I mean, they're due for an upgrade, which is some of the options that are being looked at for the next generation of air traffic control in the United States, what that option looks like. Radars in general, depending on how they're designed over time, right? So traditionally, radars have had a hard time detecting stationary objects and slow-moving objects, either from a physics standpoint or from a software standpoint where those types of targets are filtered out.
And Ryan, just to share, what is the range of, you're in the flow of a lot of this information. So from the what's shareable standpoint, what's being reported with regards to orbs, craft, and other type of phenomena? What are you seeing come through on the flow?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. There's sphere-like objects. There's been objects described as rectangles or cubes. Some of them as large as 40 feet long. There's likely a number of aircraft and consumer drones that are getting mixed into that as the populace gets more curious and essentially taking matters into their own hand in order to identify and take a closer look at these objects. I have not personally witnessed a video which shows extremely high rates of speed, although there are some stories and instances where that behavior has been described. And there's also, you know, an issue of longevity as well. These things seem to be doing whatever they're doing for 6 or 7 or 8 hours per night. They seem to be repeating their flight paths. So they'll show up in the same locations night after night and execute consistent flight mechanics or flight paths as the previous night before. And some of these things seem to be pretty darn low. I mean, this all seems to be occurring sub 3,000 feet all the way down to maybe 400 to 300 feet, which is very low. What else can I tell you?
And the what shows that they, what sensing data, radar, or otherwise we have that shows that this is, like, is it solid? These aren't projection. What type of data are you hearing that there is on these?
According to the Pentagon yesterday, they have not been able to correlate any of these sightings with their own sensor systems, which I don't necessarily buy into. And I think that statement really angered a lot of the Congress people, mayors and governors that have personally witnessed this themselves. So it's been a dearth of data.
But there's also private. So maybe the next question is, who in the private sector has the assets that they may be allocating towards this? Because some of this, there's advanced equipment and then there's things that people have access to. So do you think there are folks that are not, that are outside of the Department of Defense and or government who might have access to the sensing data?
I think that's possible, though I'm not aware of anyone specifically who's operating a commercial technology outside of just your handheld cameras or your off-the-shelf camera systems. People trying to take a look. I mean, I've heard people trying to fly their personal drones up to these objects.
Could you just do a radar gun? I mean, like, I'm not a radar expert, but you know, like, what do you need to
do it
yourself radar?
Yeah, I mean,
New Jersey, do it yourself radar.
I mean, you have radar systems at work, electro-optical systems, IR systems, normal visual spectrum camera systems that you could utilize, potentially acoustic systems. And these are all things that people within the UAP community have looked at. The Galileo project is looking at a lot of these different options for base stations. I hope they had the ability to bring a station out there, but I'm not sure if they have. But there still seems to be a problem with the fidelity of the sighting. The guys are taking their professional photographers are taking their equipment out. But it just seems like you can't get these things in focus for whatever reason. There have been military flights that have tried to use military-grade IR sensing systems in order to track these objects. They have not been able to track these objects with their systems for whatever reason. So
is there an implementation of more of a scan? Because if there's some sort of light bending or cloaking phenomena, is it kind of, it's like if you go after a fish underwater, it's not where you think you got to sick the fish? Is there kind of that more look around, span the horizon, as opposed to just that location where it shows up visually for the eye?
I don't know. That could be an option. When we don't know what we're dealing with and we're using off-the-shelf sensor technology, we're going to be prone to errors in the modalities that we're selecting. You know, it's kind of a grab bag of what you have available and seeing what the results are. But clearly, both from statements from the Pentagon and people on the ground, these seem to be exhibiting some type of signal management that is making them harder to detect both visually as well as through sensor systems as well.
And Ryan, you're accepting.
I apologize. I have to hop off right now.
And Ryan, did you want to let anybody know, and we can follow up with Diane on how to find you on inbound to know in terms of people who have methods or information to share?
Absolutely. I would encourage them to go to safeaerospace.org. We recently upgraded our website and have the reporting form on the site as now, or have the reporting system available on the website right now so that you can submit your reports. And we do have the ability to ensure those get into the right hands for follow-on investigation. And my email's on there too for particular sensing modalities that people might be interested in discussing.
Yeah, we'll make sure that contact information is available in the show notes so that what your good work is in the hands of as many as we can within our network. And
yeah, that's certainly part of it. But, you know, it's hard to tell what's an orb and what's a out of focus object with the type of imagery that I've seen thus far. But certainly on the eye sightings, what's the right way to say that? Eyewitness.
What color are we hearing on the orbs?
A red, white, and some green. So, but it's hard to tell what's an orb. But for the eyesight ones, they seem pretty confident on the shape. But I apologize. I do need to hop.
Great to see you, Ryan. Thanks so much. Oh,
thanks, Ryan.
Ryan.
Wow.
Yeah. And with that, we will need to wrap it up. But this has been fascinating. And I do want to wrap it up.
But just want to say that people are excited about information, right? They're nervous about information. A lot of gratitude for your decades of work, Leslie. Lots of gratitude for your work at Enigma, Christy. I think that this kind of mix of humanity have so many creative people, so many people with information and data. So let's just remember there are many sources of data, many sources of innovation. And there are lots of individuals and entities that decide how things move forward. So we look forward to continuing the conversation, and we're grateful for your leadership in opening up the conversation for all of us. And for also the outreach that you do on this topic. And I heard Maryland, New Jersey, New York, Texas, Virginia, Florida, Illinois, amongst other places, 3,000 FBI tips. Some of the quality is going down as is more inbound. You know, we heard Oregon, commercial air flights, a lot on Twitter and comms. So again, there's a lot to work through with regards to what's misinformation, what's terrestrial, what might be something else. But having the dialogue helps us get to what it is and what it isn't. Grateful to have you all.
So for our listeners, if you've enjoyed this and would like to stay connected, please subscribe and let us know what you think at all of your favorite podcast sources. And as always, at shushandworks.com. Thanks, everyone, again. Until next time.